It's Wednesday, March 20th. Can you be pulled over for border crossing deep in the heart of Texas? You start here. A controversial law is greenlit by the Supreme Court only to be paused hours later.
I think it's the right policy for the state of Texas. We have to have a secure border.
A judicial Texas two-step is unfolding with huge consequences for anyone who might even look like a migrant. Two white deputies are sentenced for torturing black suspects.
They spend 90 minutes brutalizing and torturing these men in different ways.
The reckoning has just begun in Mississippi. More deputies are still to be sentenced. And with no prime minister, is Haiti up for grabs?
So you stay here. You stay here.
Our team is on the ground as street battles become an all-out war. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. So a few months ago, lawmakers in Texas passed this new law. It's called Senate Bill 4. So, by the way, whenever you hear me say SB4, that's what I'm talking about. Senate Bill 4.
Senate Bill 4, cracking down on human smuggling and stash houses, is now law in the state of Texas.
This law makes it a state crime to cross the border into Texas illegally, which sounds simple, right? But think about what that means for a second.
It hurts us to our core. And y'all don't understand that. Y'all don't live in our skin.
It's already a federal crime to cross a border illegally. That's enforced by federal authorities like Customs and Border Patrol. And within those government entities, there are all sorts of federal rules about how someone crossing the border is allowed to be apprehended, how they're supposed to be treated once they are taken into custody. Well, under a state law, new rules get enforced by totally different groups with totally different standards. Instead of federal authorities, you're talking about, say, Texas state troopers. Instead of federal immigration judges, you might be talking about locally elected judges presiding over trials. And instead of federal rules about asylum claims, there is a new bar for what will put you under suspicion.
My own sons, if they're walking anywhere near a border with a backpack on, they can be grabbed up and arrested just simply for existing.
This law was a controversial one. In fact, it was being held up in federal court as it was appealed. Well, yesterday, the U.S. Supreme Court decided it could go into effect immediately. This wasn't the court saying the law will hold up under scrutiny. They're basically saying, while we figure this out, while it gets appealed, let her rip. Conservative lawmakers were thrilled.
I think it's the right policy for the state of Texas. We have to have a secure border. And that's not just a Republican, you know, ideal. That is independents, that is swing voters, that's even some Democrats.
Well then, just hours later, last night, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is holding a hearing on this today, said that a suspension instituted by a lower court can now be honored. That lower court had said this law is unconstitutional. The Fifth Circuit had paused their suspension. Well, now it's back on. Got all that? Yeah, I didn't think so. Long story short, SB 4 is back on hold. Rulings are changing by the hour, and the process for dealing with migrants in Texas is teetering. Let's start the day with ABC's Maria Villarreal, who's based in Texas. Maria, I think the most important thing to understand here is, can you just walk us through what this law would actually do if it does go into effect?
So SB 4, in essence, is a way to combat the large groups of migrants that were coming in and really trying to mitigate what is happening along the border on the state side of it. SB 4, the biggest thing it would allow local law enforcement to do is basically arrest somebody that they believe crossed into the United States illegally. So in other words, they circumvented a port of entry, a bridge, for example, in Eagle Pass, Texas. This concerned a lot of immigration advocates because they believed that this would basically encourage racial profiling by law enforcement agencies that didn't really understand all of the caveats of what federal immigration laws are all about. I mean, when you have a Border Patrol agent, I mean, he is, you know, months, if not years in training when it comes to dealing with these kinds of issues. And now you're giving the power of a federal agent who specializes in this to local law enforcement. One of the other things we should probably mention is how local state troopers or local law enforcement, how are they going to actually deal with the federal government? And by that, I mean, like, okay, let's just say you have somebody that is pulled in by using SB4 and it is jailed. And at one point or another, you want to repatriate them. Well, you know, as far as I know, the state of Texas and DPS troopers don't have the wherewithal, the means to actually send somebody back to their home country. So inevitably, they're going to have some sort of relationship, some sort of cooperation with the federal government and ICE, Immigration Customs Enforcement, in order to send people back to their home countries. And so I think this is a situation where SB4, in essence, might feel like it is solving a lot of immigration problems for the state of Texas. But inevitably, they're still going to have to work closely with the feds to figure this all out.
Okay, well, so for a span of hours yesterday, I guess, this law basically was in effect, right? And even though there's now this pause from the Fifth Circuit, you certainly don't get the impression that the 6-3 Supreme Court majority will hesitate to say once again, you turn the spigot back on, like SB4 is the law of the land. So, I mean, if that happens, what would it look like? Like, will Texas troopers be stopping people within hours, within days? What happens?
That's a really good question, Brad. I mean, at this point, I have spoken with DPS troopers. A lot of them have said that they have been tweaking their plans for months now, once they knew that SB4 could be a possibility. So for them, they have used the plan that was put in place by Operation Lone Star, which is to arrest people for criminal trespassing. That would mean picking them up along the river if they see them trespassing on private property, putting them in a holding facility, whether it's in Del Rio, Texas, or Laredo, Texas, then they would be magistrated within 24 hours and then potentially put in a state or local prison, a jail. I mean, that is the same exact plan and template that they're going to use in this situation. They're going to wait, though, a little while. For them, it's a matter of making sure that they have their transportation in place, make sure that local law enforcement understands what they're doing. DPS leadership is meeting today with the governor's office as well to make sure they have their ducks in a row. I mean, the one thing I will say, after speaking with several troopers that have been very close in the planning process of this all, is they want to make it clear that for them, this isn't a, we're going to stop you on a random road on the interior of Texas and ask for your papers. As of right now, the way they're explaining this to me is, this is meant to be used on the border, near the river, where we can actually see people, you know, circumventing a port of entry, a legal port of entry. And for them, it's also about gathering the evidence that will enable them to enforce a criminal trespassing type of violation. So, you know, I think there's a lot of worry about what this could mean in the future. But as of right now, I think we're going to have to wait and see.
Right, because the text of the law does not say it's just going to be used at the border. Like, you know, officers might tell you that, but it doesn't mean that that's where they would have to stop. It doesn't mean that they can't stop someone who seems just vaguely suspicious, which is why you get so many people very worried about what this could mean to their American family members. Again, all this will be considered again today by the Fifth Circuit, so we'll look to see if anything flips once again. Maria Villarreal, thank you so much.
All right, thanks, Brad.
Next up on Start Here, they called themselves the Goon Squad, and they weren't joking. We're back in a bit.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan. It's one of potentially four trials facing former President Trump as he makes his third bid for the White House. What do voters think about his culpability, and would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you.
You hear the word torture. It might sound very foreign, right? Something that happens in other countries under despotic regimes, or something that used to happen a really long time ago. Well, yesterday, two deputies in Mississippi were sentenced to years in prison for their role in the torture of two suspects just last year. This goes beyond one or two bad cops. Potentially, it goes beyond one case. ABC's Faith Abube has been covering this case. Faith, we're talking about white cops and black suspects, right? I mean, what's going on here?
Well, this was a horrific, racially motivated crime perpetrated by law enforcement. And it's really hard to fathom that it happened just last year and not decades ago. And so what we've learned over the course of this case is that, you know, this all started back in January of last year. A white neighbor in Rankin County, Mississippi, called a deputy, an investigator with the sheriff's office, and wanted to report several black men for suspicious behavior at a nearby house. You know, there was even a mention that these black men were living in that house with a white woman, among other things. So this deputy decides it was worth looking into, and, you know, he reached out to his friends, a group of officers who call themselves the Goon Squad. We learned through court documents that they describe themselves that way because of their willingness to go beyond what's allowed, what's legally allowed. They use excessive force in the course of their jobs, and then they sweep it under the rug, essentially. So these white officers, four sheriff's deputies and a police officer, they show up at the house in question here. They break in without a warrant, and then they handcuff the two black men in that house, Michael Jenkins and Eddie Parker, without any evidence of crime being committed. And that's where the story really gets grisly.
In their minds, the law and the Constitution be damned. They became the criminals they swore to protect us from.
These officers, they spend 90 minutes brutalizing and torturing these men in different ways, calling them racial slurs. The victims say they were sometimes waterboarded during the course of this. The deputies poured alcohol, syrup, milk on their faces while they laid there on the ground. They forced them to strip naked and shower together just to try to wipe off the evidence here. And then used stun guns repeatedly on them, a sex toy on them, and other objects, just assaulting them. Again, this went on for about an hour and a half. And then it gets worse. One of the officers, Elward, puts a gun in Michael Jenkins' mouth and pulls the trigger, shooting him execution style.
Wow.
He said that, you know, it was a mock execution that really went wrong. He didn't know that there was a bullet in that gun.
Looking at me, I'm looking at him, and he sat there for a minute, and he pulled the trigger.
The bullet goes through Jenkins' tongue, goes through the back of his neck, and he's laying on the floor there. He's bleeding. These officers realize how bad the situation has gotten. And so instead of rendering aid, helping this guy, they huddle together to come up with a plan to cover up this crime. They take evidence from that house, some security footage. They plant a gun and some drugs to make it look like it was a drug bust. And then to add salt to injury, these victims were then criminally charged and had to spend months and months clearing their names before finally getting to this point where these officers are being sentenced for these crimes.
Yeah, I was going to say, usually you'd be using the word allegedly. Like, if we're in the middle of a case, that's not what's happening here, right? Like, all six of these men have been convicted. What is happening now with the sentence of these first two former deputies?
Yeah, so two deputies were sentenced yesterday, one to 20 years in prison, another one to 17 years. Over the course of the next 2 days, today we're expecting two more to be sentenced, and then on Thursday, the other two will be sentenced here. And that's just the beginning. And then there are also state charges that they're facing. They've admitted to those as well, so they will be sentenced in that case as well. Now, prosecutors are also looking at other cases that are connected to these officers.
Abusive law enforcement officers will not be tolerated in any of our communities, and we will pursue justice and accountability.
What have they been doing? Is this the first time? Who else knew what? And all of these cases are being reviewed that they've ever touched. And of course, this is just the beginning.
Well, I'm wondering what this has meant to the community there in Mississippi, because this sounds like something you'd read out of, you know, a Mississippi Burning type novel or something. When we talk about law enforcement and the black populace of Mississippi, what is being said around the courtroom and around the state today?
I mean, the details are hard to believe, but for this community, you know, there are obviously a lot of questions about, again, how deep does this rottenness go, right? Mm. Did it affect the entire police department or the entire sheriff's department? Who else knew?
I ain't feel nothing. I feel like you did exactly what you did.
And so after that sentencing yesterday, you know, we heard from the two victims here.
Are you happy with 20 years?
I'm satisfied.
One of them talked about how satisfied he is in terms of the sentences that came down. The other one also talked about how, you know, this is justice and that this was long overdue.
Ms. Parker said that you forgave Hunter Elward. Do you feel the same way?
No, I don't. I don't. Because if you wouldn't have got caught, you should be doing the same thing.
Jenkins, who was the one who was shot, says that, you know, he has not forgiven the officer here in this case. And so there's a lot of healing that they still have to go through. They're still living with a lot of trauma. And actually, there was a moment inside the courtroom as Elward was being sentenced where right before he had a chance to speak to the court, and he turned around and looked at the victims here and basically apologized for what he did. He said he hates himself for what he did.
It'll make my great-great-great-grandkids, it will let them have a different life. I hope they will never have to worry about this.
These victims are hoping that this case can sort of be an example of what can happen when, you know, claims of police brutality are taken seriously and critically examined. But again, this is only one chapter of the long road to justice for them. They're also filing a civil rights lawsuit for $400 million that these officers are going to have to face as well. So again, a lot here, and this is just the beginning, it seems.
All right. Faith Abube, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The promise from Haiti's gangs was if the prime minister stepped down, the violence would stop. Well, last week, amid mounting pressure from both inside and outside his country, the prime minister of Haiti, Ariel Henry, did resign. And yet, predictably, the violence has not stopped. After all, there's now a power vacuum in a country off the Florida coast, just past Cuba, and in the midst of this open warfare to claim that power, ABC's foreign correspondent Matt Rivers has made his way into the country of Haiti. He is there this morning in Port-au-Prince. We go to him now. Matt, what is it like there on the ground?
You know, Brad, I've been to Port-au-Prince a lot over the years, and I think it's safe to say it would take a lot to shock me in this country. And what I've seen on the ground here really has. I mean, even just getting in, the only way you can get in relatively safely is by helicopter. So we managed to hitch a ride on a helicopter. We landed not at the airport, but at an undisclosed landing zone somewhere else in Port-au-Prince, because the airport remains closed and we don't publicize the landing zone for operational security concerns for the people who brought us in. But that is what it takes just to get in here. This is completely cut off from the outside world.
Burned out cars on the right, straight ahead.
Inside here, we've gone all around the city over the last couple of days. Some of these places, including downtown Port-au-Prince, where that national penitentiary was, where all those inmates were freed during the prison break a couple weeks ago, where the National Palace is, where the Interior Ministry is, where hospitals are, it is a utter war zone. It reminded me of when I went to certain villages in Ukraine when I was there. Burnt out cars, spent shell casings on the ground.
There's a bullet hole right in the door here.
Absolutely empty, an apocalyptic feel. It was the aftermath of a battle between gangs and police that lasted for days. And that's the kind of thing that you see in different neighborhoods all around Port-au-Prince. And the violence is ongoing. It was just earlier this week on Monday, where not far from where we're staying, 13 people were massacred within a quarter mile stretch. Now, we don't know who did that. No one took responsibility for it. But that's just an example of the kind of violence that is continuing all across Port-au-Prince right now. It's really staggering. And to your point, right off the top, if we talk politics just for a second, Ariel Henry, the prime minister, the acting prime minister, did resign. But effective if and when a transitional presidential council is approved. Not to get too deep in the weeds here, but that presidential transition council has not yet even been announced. And the gangs have been watching kind of how it's forming. They've already come out publicly and say they're not going to accept it, even if and when it does get announced. So the stage is already set for this violence to continue. And there's no obvious solution about how we finish it.
So in the gang's mindset, they're like, well, we didn't say we'd step down yet. It's actually other stuff has to happen. But if you're a civilian living there or anywhere in Haiti, eventually you got to come out just to get food or to get groceries. Forget about even going to work or something. But anyway, so what is it like for civilians there at this point?
You know, you drive around the city here, and if there is no violence, people have to come out. I mean, it's not like people can just stay in their homes 24/7 forever. People are going out. We have seen people in some markets. We have seen people going to get some food, but that's only when the violence abates. And the second the violence crops back up, people retreat inside. But even if there is food right now, consider where we are. It's Haiti. It's an island. They import a lot of their food. How? Through highways and through the ports. Well, if the port is closed and the airport is closed and the highways leading to the Dominican Republic are completely controlled by gangs, well, where does the aid come from? And that's the conversations that I've been having with experts here in Haiti, people that we've spoken to who say this country could quite literally run out of food relatively soon. You're talking about millions and millions of people who don't have enough to eat. And there was a hunger crisis before this began. Yesterday, we made our way over to a makeshift shelter. And by shelter, what it actually is the abandoned Ministry of Communications, a federal level ministry here in Haiti that, because this is a failed state, they have basically abandoned that building and it has now been taken over by hundreds of internally displaced people.
And when you say problems, you mean gangs fighting?
Again, that's about gangs. About the gangs.
Were the gangs killing people in your neighborhood?
Every inch of floor space is covered. Obviously, there's not enough bathroom facilities. There's not enough food and water to go around.
So you stay here. You stay here.
And we spoke to one particular woman who actually lived very close to the National Palace, very close to that downtown area that I described earlier today that saw horrific fighting.
Tell me what happened. Tell me why you're here.
When that fighting broke out, she hid in her home for about 2 days, she told me. Second that there was a break in the fighting, she took her 11-year-old son and they ran. They had nothing but the clothes on their backs, and they eventually made it to that Ministry of Communications / shelter.
How difficult has this been for you and for your son?
And the thing that she said to me that really stood out to me the most is she said, I'm trying to find food and water for my son, and I can't. And her story is happening over and over and over again on this island right now. It's just a little microcosm of what's playing out.
How do you stop? Can you stop that? Because if you're a police officer there, seems like gangs have already won, right? Like, game over. So does this now just continue until there's some sort of new government there, or until it's just an organized crime state and the gangs run everything for real?
If there's one government institution that's hanging on by literal threads, it is the National Police. I think people have watched the National Police over the past couple of weeks, those National Police who are actually still showing up to work, and they're fighting the gangs every day all around the city. And that's the only thing that is standing between the gangs and taking over this country 100%.
Bonjour.
Bonjour.
Ça va?
Ça va.
And so we actually had a conversation with a police officer who we are protecting his identity for his own safety, who goes out every day sometimes, and is the one who's on the front lines fighting with these gangs.
Are the gangs in some cases better armed? Do they have better weapons than the police?
He said the gangs are almost always better armed than they are. They have more ammunition. They have more men. They don't have better tactics, according to him, which is the only reason why the National Police are being able to hang on. What he's saying is that they need help. He said he can't even find body armor that isn't expired. And yet he's going out every single day risking his life without any leadership.
Who are you fighting for? Because you're out there risking your life every day. So why do you keep doing this? Who are you fighting for?
And he basically said, this is my country. I don't want it to be run by gangs. We still have a mission to protect and serve. And while that might sound cliche, I talked to this guy. I looked in his eyes. He believes it. And you know he believes it because he's living that every single day by risking his life going out there and trying to save the city from these gangs.
And we keep talking about how close Haiti is to the U.S. Like, that's a key part, I think, of why it's so bizarre to watch this unfolding so close to American shores. You got to remember, there are lots of Americans there in Haiti right now. The State Department has only done one evacuation flight. It was from a place that's kind of difficult to get to for a lot of Americans. They say, if you can get to our embassy safely, we might be able to get you out, but that's not a given. And those rides going out at this point might be on those helicopters from these landing zones that you were describing, Matt. All right, Matt Rivers there in Port-au-Prince. Stay safe, and thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, one more quick break. When we come back, Photoshop a royal portrait once, shame on you, but do it twice and we got a full-blown scandal. Pip, pip, one last thing is next.
Wednesday night on ABC, Brittany Griner, for the first time since being released from a Russian prison, shares her story.
You've been told to go through your bag and you felt...
Felt the cartridge.
What were you thinking at that moment when you felt that?
My life is over right here.
Her sentence.
Just been told you're going to be 9 years in one of the worst prisons in Russia.
I was just so scared for everything because there's just so much unknown.
Brittany Griner, Robin Roberts, Prisoner in Russia. Wednesday night at 10, 9 central on ABC.
And one last thing. Remember a couple weeks ago when Kensington Palace, the domain of Prince William and Princess Kate in England, released a photo of the princess who hasn't been spotted in months? And remember when it became clear this photo was obviously edited and Kate took responsibility for that, saying she occasionally experiments with photo editing? Well, maybe we should have been asking how long these experiments have been happening. Wait, Maggie, there's another photo?
I know, Brad. It's hard to believe there is another photo from the royal family that's being called into question.
That's ABC's foreign correspondent, Maggie Rooley, who's based in London, where, once again, everyone is flabbergasted by a royal family portrait, this one featuring the late Queen Elizabeth.
And this was, Brad, a beautiful family portrait. In it, you see the late queen sitting on the couch with all of her grandchildren and great-grandchildren, or most of her grandchildren and great-grandchildren. And it's very nice. They're all surrounding her. What could go wrong, you ask, Brad? Well, now, Getty Images, a very well-respected photo agency, has put up an editor's notice on their site saying that this image could be digitally enhanced.
Digitally enhanced, as in edited, put through some Photoshop-type program.
It's things like a weird vertical line in the queen's skirt. There's also weird lines in the couch that don't seem to add up. And then get this one, there also appears to be sort of almost a weird black splotch behind some of the grandchildren's heads.
What could have happened here? Well, ABC News spoke to photo experts who say this is the sort of thing you'd do if you wanted to take the best shots of everyone. Maybe one kid's eyes are closed in one photo, another kid is frowning in another, or maybe someone's not there that day, you try to digitally add them in later. What's bizarre is not just that Kensington Palace is apparently sending out altered photographs despite constantly telling journalists if it doesn't come straight from us, it shouldn't be trusted. What's extra strange here is that Kate was credited as the photographer in this photograph too. Wait, honest question. Does the palace not have enough money just to hire a portrait photographer? Like, they don't have a JCPenney's or something? They gotta get Kate herself taking all the photos. Did she edit this one as well?
Yeah, so nothing's been said so far from the palace about this photo they released in 2023 of the late queen. But now that we have the second photo being called into question for somewhat egregious editing errors, I think a lot of people will be wondering who's sort of behind the photos at Kensington Palace.
And this is the central thing to understand here. As of last week, Kate hadn't been seen in public in months after what is still a pretty mysterious medical condition involving an abdominal surgery. Some wondered if the palace got caught trying to fake a photo of a happy, healthy princess and then try to pawn the whole thing off on Kate. But this older photo raises the stakes. Either Kate once again takes responsibility for manipulating photos, or palace officials have to admit they're not above doing it themselves. This has led to bigger conspiracy theories, which are no longer being limited to still photos.
Kate was reportedly seen this weekend shopping for plants with Prince William. And
this weekend, for the first time in months, William and Kate were spotted in the wild. They were shopping, carrying bags.
Kate appears to be walking quite easily. She's even seen smiling. So many people are saying, okay, good. We've seen her. That's great. She's fine. She's looking good. other people are still questioning the validity of this video, questioning if it's her in the video.
That's right. Hardcore conspiracy theorists are now asking if William was traveling with a body double. Why is there only one video, they ask? Why is it so grainy? There's no evidence to suggest that any of this was staged, but this is also what happens when trust with the public is broken. King Charles is going out of the way to be photographed in public, despite ailing from cancer. Health is private, but it's going to take more and more to satisfy the British public. I was not expecting to dedicate this much brain power to knowing about the royal family this year. I generally don't care about it that much, but now I am here for it all. More on all these stories at abcnews.com or the ABC News app. I'm Brad Milkey. I'll see you later.
Wednesday night on ABC, Brittany Griner, for the first time since being released from a Russian prison, shares her story.
You've been told to go through your bag, and you felt
the cartridge.
What were you thinking that moment when you felt that?
My life is over right here.
Her sentence.
Just been told you're going to be 9 years in one of the worst prisons in Russia.
I was just so scared for everything, because there's just so much up.
Brittany Griner, Robin Roberts, Prisoner in Russia. Wednesday night at 10, 9 central on ABC.